Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Christopher Wilson. He's the deputy director of the Mexico Institute at the Wilson Center, a research institute in Washington, D.C. He has prior work experience in the United States and Mexico on trade and border issues. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Grant.
Well, let me start with just some basic laying of the land here. I wanted to get a sense of the amount of trade that exists between the United States and Mexico. I think most of us know that it's a lot, but let's just start by trying to quantify it a bit. Roughly, what percentage of the U.S. Gross domestic product is accounted for by trade with Mexico, and what percentage of the Mexican economy is accounted for by trade with the U.S.?
Yeah, I don't have it exactly in GDP terms, but for the United States, it would be a relatively small percentage of GDP, you know, very small, actually. But in terms of our percentage of overall exports, we send about 15% of all of our exports to Mexico.
Okay.
Mexico's our third largest trading partner behind only Canada and China. And there's about $500 billion of trade every year between the United States and Mexico. That means that every day there's more than $1 billion worth of goods moving back and forth across the U.S.-Mexico border. Every minute there's $1 million of commerce between our two countries. We send more exports to Mexico than to all of the BRIC countries combined. So if you add up what we export to Brazil, Russia, India, and China, that still doesn't add up to what we export to Mexico every year.
And I imagine that the magnitude, relatively speaking, is greater for Mexico because they have a smaller economy than ours.
Yeah, it's totally asymmetric in that sense. It's very important for both countries, of course, but Mexico sends 80% of its exports to the United States. And Mexico is a very trade-dependent country. So when you add up imports and exports and put them over GDP in Mexico, you get somewhere around two-thirds of their economy that represents. Now, that's not exactly a fair way to do it. It doesn't mean that actually two-thirds of all economic activity in Mexico related to trade, but a huge chunk is. I mean, that this is an economy that depends on trade, and within that depends very heavily on the U.S. market.
And that what you just said there kind of leads to the other question I wanted to ask in this regard, just sort of setting the stage, is that I would think that the economic effects of trade between the two countries, they spread out into the two countries' economies in far-reaching ways that may not be readily apparent at first. I mean, thinking about the supplies that are needed in sectors and industries that produce other things, for example. So give us a sense of kind of the downstream effects there.
Yeah, that's just it. You know, the U.S.-Mexico relationship is not just big, but it's deep. And it's rather unique in that sense. I mean, our relationship with Canada is similar, but only with neighbors that are so close together do you have such deep supply chain connections. And so actually half of U.S.-Mexico trade is trade in intermediate goods. Those are the inputs that go to support manufacturing or other production processes on the other side of the border. So we have, you know, parts and materials that are actually moving back and forth across the border, you know, six or seven times in certain cases as a product is being made. So, you know, the little screws made here, it's put into another piece here, it's put into a fuel injector there, it's put into a motor on the other side, and final assembly is done, and, you know, the product shipped back to the other side of the border. So it's this really deep supply chain connections that make our countries economic partners much more than economic competitors. There is competition. Of course, there's competition to attract investments and for specific aspects of production. But on the bigger scale, you know, we really are economic partners because we're building things together that get sold on the global market.
That example you gave is really interesting because it makes me think if there's a hitch in any of that, then it really kind of throws a monkey wrench into the system. Or if there's some sort of general hitch in that, then it just slows things down dramatically because there are all these different intersections there.
Yeah, and there's two really important ways that plays out. One would be the management of the border. So if, you know, it takes an extra 4 hours, which can happen easily, even longer sometimes, to get across, you know, to get a product across the U.S.-Mexico border, a factory could actually have to stop running on the other side of the border because they don't get their supplies in time. Now, this is called just-in-time supply chain management, which a lot of companies are moving towards as a way to reduce inventory costs. It means they depend very heavily on a functioning U.S.-Mexico border. The other thing is that there's a multiplier effect for tariffs. So if we have if the United States puts a tariff on goods coming in from Mexico, say it was across the board, you wouldn't just pay that tariff once as a product was being made, but every time those goods are moving back and forth across the border, the entire value of that product would essentially, in most cases, be tariffed.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Christopher Wilson, the Deputy Director of the Mexico Institute at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. So thinking then of this is how the trade works and the magnitude of the economy that is involved in it, has this trade so far been affected by any of the political controversies over the border?
Very little. We saw actually in 2017 trade grew again between the two countries. 2018 numbers are incomplete still, but looking like there's still, you know, a large and growing amount of U.S.-Mexico trade. The trade deficit hasn't really changed very much, which was another one of the things sort of brought into the political spotlight by the Trump administration and the Trump campaign. It's business as usual in many ways. I'd say the one place where we do see some impact is not in the trade numbers itself, but in some investments that maybe companies are sitting on. They're saying, you know, there's this cloud of uncertainty sort of hanging over the Mexican economy, over this North American relationship, and we'd love to go and build that next factory, but maybe we'll just wait a year or two and see where things stand before we decide to pull the trigger on that.
Yeah, that's kind of leads into something else I wanted to ask in this regard, which is, in thinking about, at least my observations as a non-economist, the ups and downs of the trade talks and potential trade deals between the United States and different countries around the world, it does seem to affect the American economy in one way, and that's in terms of the stock market. It seems like the stock market is very sensitive in reacting to what somebody says or the interpretation of the tone of what somebody says. In those kind of negotiations, do you see any comparable effects in Mexico and their economy in that regard, in terms of the conversations that go back and forth, in terms of leading up to this new deal that we have yet to discuss, but we're going to discuss? But how does that play out in Mexico?
Yeah, if anything, it's magnified in Mexico, you know, because of exactly what we started with, the fact that Mexico's economy depends even more heavily than the U.S. economy on access to the U.S. market, on trade between our two countries. And so, you know, and this is something that we've seen time and again, when the U.S. coughs, Mexico catches a flu. It's, you know, it's because it's a smaller economy serving this larger economy. It's like a couple of sort of cogs that are different sizes. When one spins at one speed, the other has to spin, you know, five times as fast to catch up. So if there's a little bit of a slowdown on the U.S. side, that has really big effects on the Mexican side. All of that said, I also witnessed an effect as the NAFTA negotiations were going on, in which the Mexicans and people in the United States started to become a little bit immune to the rhetoric. You know, they early on in the administration and the Trump administration, when anything was said about Mexico, Mexican investment, about trade, the potential for tariffs, there would be a really big shift in stock values. And with time, I think people said, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric and we're not sure what's going to happen. So we're just going to lay off a little bit on making moves and, you know, selling stocks as a result of these statements.
So let's talk about this new trade deal then. Canada, the United States, and Mexico signed a new trade deal last November. It's called the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. It doesn't exactly have a ring to it like NAFTA, but it's okay.
Okay.
USMCA. It would replace the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is better known as NAFTA. My understanding is the deal still needs to be ratified by the three governments, and which means in the United States, Congress is going to have to approve it. So let's get some basics here again. First, broadly, everybody talks about NAFTA, but what did it establish and change? Let's just start with NAFTA.
Yeah. NAFTA was one of the first U.S. trade agreements, the free trade agreements. And so what it did is it brought tariffs, those are the taxes on imports, into the countries, all three countries of North America in this case, it brought them to zero. So it basically said, you know, if you want to import a car into the United States from Mexico, you don't have to pay a special tax on that. If you want to import an apple from Washington into Mexico, you don't have to pay a tax on that. It also had some protections for investors in order to try to stimulate investments in these supply chains that we were talking about, factories on both sides of the border. And actually, an interesting sort of side note is that Mexican investment in the United States, while still smaller than U.S. investment in Mexico, has been growing at very high rates recently. But, you know, that's what it was. It was a trade and investment agreement. I think it was sold as much more than that. It was sort of sold as a ticket to the first world for Mexico. It was sold as a solution to an immigration challenge in the United States. And if we judge it on those terms, it was definitely a failure. It didn't do either of those things. But if we, you know, judge it as a trade and investment agreement designed to spur both of those, well, it did just that.
I remember at the time, and it's remained the case. I mean, particularly if we think about some of the back and forth in the 2016 presidential election, but it was controversial, I think, even at the time in terms of what it did or didn't do for labor regulations. And one of the concerns was that you've opened these markets up, but a worker in Mexico is paid far less than a worker in the United States, and also the regulations more generally on how those industries operate are lower, and so you've kind of set up, in a sense, a race to the bottom in terms of wages. How did that play out?
Yeah, I mean, this was a big concern. So the NAFTA was the first U.S. trade agreement with a developing country. Actually, the first time in the world that there was a trade agreement between a developed country and a developing country. So these were new issues that were sort of being explored at the time that agreement was negotiated. When the Clinton administration took over after the first Bush administration had negotiated NAFTA, they decided that they wanted to add sort of side agreements on labor and the environment. And that was something that was important to Clinton himself and the Democratic caucus in order to get that deal through Congress. And so there were some sort of assurances put in place that Mexico in particular wouldn't lower its environmental standards, would respect basic workers' rights as a part of this agreement. Now, those were side agreements. They weren't fully enforceable. And they were sort of limited in what they accomplished. And so there's actually, as a part of this new iteration of the trade agreement, you know, they move from side agreements into the agreement itself, and they become stronger and more enforceable. So there's some progress that's been made in that sense. But, you know, when we look back at just sort of the reality on the ground, I guess I'd say that on the environmental front, we did not see a race to the bottom. There's not evidence that companies were moving out of the United States into Mexico in order to not follow environmental regulations. There have been some challenges, sort of very particular challenges that have arisen, but in a general sense, that hasn't been an issue. On the labor front, you know, it's much more complicated. Certainly, lower wages in Mexico is one of the attractive things about working there. But I always help, you know, I think it's easy to think that all investment decisions are made based on what labor costs are, that companies are just sort of racing around the world looking for the cheapest wages. Well, Mexico wouldn't be the place that you would go if wages were the only thing that mattered. There are plenty of countries around the world with much lower wages. And certainly certain things are produced in those countries. But Mexico has this sort of mix of lower costs of labor than the United States, but also a pretty skilled workforce that can build complex things like cars and airplanes. You know, the Mexican economy 40 years ago was a place where you made t-shirts and jeans. The Mexican economy today is a place where you build cars and airplanes. The U.S. economy is a place where you design cars and airplanes and iPhones and all of that, right? So there's, you know, changes in all of our economies that change exactly what you need. But you need skills, you need low energy costs, you need good regulation. And the U.S. is, you know, stronger in some of those, and Mexico is stronger in some of those. And that's what determines where these investments are going, much more than sort of a very simplified race to the bottom that was talked about during the first NAFTA negotiations.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Christopher Wilson. He's the deputy director of the Mexico Institute at the Wilson Center, a research institute in Washington, D.C. Chris is an expert on U.S.-Mexico relations and the border. All right, so before the break, you gave a very nice and layered description of NAFTA and all the different pieces of it. Now, as a candidate, President Trump said that was a bad deal for the United States, and candidates like Bernie Sanders also had pretty negative things to say about it as well from the labor front, which you already talked about. Was it a bad deal? Is it possible sort of just to evaluate it that simply? Did the United States come off on the short end of this?
No, I don't believe so. I think that what this is really, you know, I mean, there's two ways that you can sort of judge trade agreements, and I think we get mixed up between them. One is, you know, is the trade deficit. So sort of it's seeing this as a pie that can't grow and saying who gets the bigger slice of the pie. And the United States had a trade surplus with Mexico before NAFTA. Now we have a small, in global terms, trade deficit with Mexico. But I think the real point is that you can grow the pie and you can make things better, you know, on both sides. There's not a winner and a loser in a trade agreement. Otherwise, neither side would ever agree to one. We have two winners in a trade agreement, and in my mind, that is what happened with NAFTA. Now, that said, it is really important to say that there are distributional impacts as a result of trade agreements. There are more winners than losers in the United States, but there have been losers in the United States. And I don't think that we as a country have done enough to deal with that fact. Mm. So there are factories that went out of business as a result of NAFTA. There were factories in Mexico that went out of business as a result of NAFTA as well, because they had a challenge, trouble competing with, you know, sort of strong U.S. companies. But in certain industries where labor costs are very important, there was a movement of certain factories to Mexico. And so the question is, what do you do with those workers?
And just to interrupt, would those be concentrated in the upper Midwest there, those states that Trump carried by small margins and made the difference in the election?
That's precisely it. They sort of Rust Belt states where, you know, the sort of traditional manufacturing base of the United States, heavy industry. These are the things that have in part moved to Mexico. And so, yeah, I mean, there's something that's called trade adjustment assistance that was put in place to try to help some of these workers when NAFTA was voted on. But the reality is it's been too small of a program and too ineffective of a program. And you have too many people that are left behind, not only by trade, because trade is a small piece of it, but especially also by technological change, you know, sort of the robotics and the automation that we see in factories today. But these are the same people. You know, this is really important for us to understand. The same people that are impacted negatively by globalization are the ones in the United States that are negatively impacted by technological change. And what we need to do is we need to find ways to upskill those workers so they can find jobs in the new economy. It's not about recreating the old economy, the economy of the 1950s. It's about reskilling the American workforce so that it can succeed in the 21st century. And unfortunately, we've done a pretty lousy job of that across the United States. And therefore, there's a lot of resistance to NAFTA, to globalization in general.
So let's take the new agreement then, the USMCA, United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. What are the most significant changes that made to NAFTA?
Very few. No, there are some. There are some important ones. But I think actually the starting point is recognizing that, you know, this is 90% NAFTA. This is basically the same agreement
revised
that existed
NAFTA.
Before, a revised NAFTA. The biggest changes were in the auto sector in particular. There's special rules, they call rules of origin. Essentially, you know, what does it take for a vehicle to be considered made in North America and get that tariff-free access to the other countries? Under the original NAFTA, a vehicle had to be 62.5% made in North America. 62.5% of the value of that vehicle had to come from within Mexico, Canada, or the United States for it to get tariff-free access to the other countries. Now it's up to 75%, so it's a stricter rule of origin. It means you can use less parts and materials from Asia, from Europe, as you're assembling cars in the in North America. And then the other piece of that was that there's also 40 to 45%, depending on what kind of vehicle, has to be made with workers earning wages of $16 an hour or higher.
Oh, okay.
Those essentially are workers in the United States or Canada, not sort of line workers in Mexico. Line workers in Mexico make, you know, maybe $8 a day, $10 a day, not $16 an hour. Some of the engineers and the managers in Mexico might meet that threshold. But these are the two sort of biggest changes that could actually move production networks, change the way that we build things in North America. There was also, though, a modernization of the agreement. NAFTA was negotiated 25 years ago before we all had smartphones in our pockets, before we shopped on Amazon, before we, you know, did business across the internet, sending goods and services back and forth across national barriers. And so there's a lot of just basic updating, sort of housekeeping that needed to be done to modernize an agreement that was, as we said, one of the first trade agreements the United States got into.
So it did have then one element of it was an attempt to address that labor question and wage question that I brought up earlier then.
That's right. Yeah, that was one of the key pieces of it. And there was sort of a split in the negotiations where you had, on the one hand, this modernization agenda creating a NAFTA 2.0, many would say. And then on the other hand, these sort of more protectionist agenda or sort of trying to in some ways address some of the challenges, these basic challenges that we see come up again and again, but also coming from a perspective from the United States of really what I would say is it was about trying to recreate in some ways an economy that we've already moved past.
Is it a better deal now for the United States? Is this just a better deal?
No, it's half NAFTA 2.0 and half NAFTA 0.8. So we took, you know, two steps forward, two steps back. So where do we end up? You know, I don't know how you average those two things out. NAFTA 1.4. This is better NAFTA in certain ways for the three countries. But there are also some, you know, things where there clearly are retrocessions and things that I don't actually believe will be a benefit to any of the three economies. Again, though, I have to say, this is basically NAFTA. You know, okay. This is basically still the same agreement. This sort of, you know, dependence, interdependence that has been built up, the integration of the North American production platform, the, you know, factories working together across borders, all that will remain. So, you know, more than anything, this became a political promise that required a political solution, and the economics of it are not all of that, all that different.
Was it worth all the conflict?
I'm just happy that we're for now, you know, on the other side, and that things haven't gone really negatively, that it hasn't all gone south. But we still have to ratify the agreement. And sure. In the United States, in this, you know, very polarized political environment in which we live, that is going to be no easy task, especially now that the Democrats have the House. This is something that's going to require support from both Republicans and Democrats. Not an easy thing to accomplish.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Christopher Wilson from the Mexico Institute at the Wilson Center. So we'll see where that agreement goes. Let's go back to the border issue more specifically. Things change very fast in this regard, so we need to make sure that people understand. We're talking on Friday morning. There's been an agreement on the budget, which is going to provide about a quarter of the funding for the border wall or barrier, whatever it is that we're going to call it, that the president wanted. That seems to have come together. The president is also talking now about declaring a crisis and using the executive authority to get the rest of the money that he wants. So that's where we are, I think, on Friday morning. Let me just ask a question here. Do you think that the changes in the border security that are likely to come, at least from what is in the deal that's been agreed, all right, let's just take that, is there anything in there that's going to really affect the trade between the two countries?
You know, there's actually some stuff in the agreement that will impact trade positively between the two countries. So aside from all the stuff that's been really politically charged, this debate about whether we do or do not build additional fencing or barrier along the U.S.-Mexico border, in the bill, there's also funding to modernize ports of entry in California and some other places. There's funding to hire an additional around approximately 600 customs officers. So these are not the Border Patrol officers that work to stop unauthorized migration between the ports of entry, between the official border crossing points, but those who facilitate trade and travel and ensure our security at the official border crossing. So there's some positive stuff in there. The wall, you know, it's really from a sort of economic perspective, a trade perspective, the only thing it is a symbol, right? It's a symbol of division between the United States and Mexico that makes U.S.-Mexico relations more complicated to manage. And that can have some long-term impacts on trade volumes, the sort of the ability to renegotiate an agreement, to have, you know, sort of ongoing dialogue to solve, you know, day-to-day problems. But it's not something that's going to have a big impact on the type of trade that we've been talking about.
Do you think it'll have an impact on labor supply in the United States? Because, at all different levels of economic activity, the labor coming from Mexico can be important.
Yeah, in that sense, I agree with you that, you know, immigration can have an impact on sort of labor dynamics and labor supply in the United States. I don't believe that building an extra 100 miles of wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, or even if you built more than that, would have a significant impact on overall levels of migration. I just don't think that it can be that effective. I mean, and there are a few other pieces of the bill that offer, you know, investments in technology. You know, there are things that can be done to improve border security. What we really need, though, if you want to deal with that sort of broader migration issue, is comprehensive immigration reform. And you can mean that from a sort of Republican perspective or a Democratic perspective, but we need a full-on overhaul of our immigration system. We need to find a way to do workplace enforcement. It's not a border issue. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that solving the migration problem is not something that you're really going to do at the border, and definitely not only at the border.
That has stymied three or four presidents now. So bottom line question on the border. Is the border situation as bad as the president portrays it to be?
In my opinion, there's absolutely no crisis at the border. No security crisis, I should say, at the border. There are some humanitarian crises going on. And what's really happened is, you know, back in the 90s to the early 2000s, we had a huge wave of Mexican migrants that were seeking economic opportunities in the United States. Okay, the situation has changed dramatically. For the last several years, it's no longer a majority of Mexicans that are crossing the border. Rather, they're Central Americans that are crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. And they're not just trying to escape poverty. They're also fleeing violence in their home countries. So they're very motivated to get to the United States in a way that will get them across a wall if they need to get across a wall. Mm. But they're also seeking asylum, which means that they can show up at the ports of entry and turn themselves in. They can sneak across the border and turn themselves into Border Patrol. They're not trying to sneak past. They're trying to use U.S. law and international law as a way to gain access to the United States. And so this is a totally different challenge that we're facing today. And unfortunately, I don't think that we're, you know, addressing it in that way. I think that we're treating it as if it was the problem of several decades ago, where actually, and it is true, that more border security over the last couple of decades has had some level of impact on the number of Mexican migrants trying to move for economic reasons to the United States.
We only have about 50 seconds left, but I want to try to squeeze in one last question here. It's about Mexico itself, forgetting about the border for a minute. From a distance, the country seems to be having trouble in terms of governability, in terms of corruption, in terms of the influence of drug cartels, violence. Just, you know, in 30 seconds, unfortunately. Can you give me an idea of has the situation become much worse in Mexico? Just how bad is the problem?
There's a very serious challenge in terms of having the rule of law in Mexico. That has to do with drug trafficking, but it also has to do with, you know, sort of just this, the fact that Mexico is still a nascent democracy. It wasn't until 2000 that an opposition candidate won the presidency in Mexico. And so it's a young democracy facing challenges that a lot of young democracies face. And then, you know, the drug issue and the money that comes from the United States to support that in Mexico feeds into corruption. And so the challenge is therefore much bigger. That said, let me just leave it on a little bit more positive note. Mexico is also a modern country with a growing middle class. It's all of those things at once.
That was Christopher Wilson. Chris, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks for having me, Grant.
You've been listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.